Distributing the Future, Beta Broadcast Number 2.
The future is going to be bigger than the past. There's going to be more happening. Connected systems, connected devices, connected data. What can we do in that world that will be interesting, powerful, and useful?
Changing the world through capturing the knowledge of innovators.
The future is here. It's just not evenly distributed yet.
Welcome to Distributing the Future from O'Reilly Media. I'm Daniel Steinberg, and each week we bring you the technology and the people behind what you use now and what you'll use next. In the next half hour, Tim O'Reilly on what is Web 2.0, Mark Hedlund on how the browsers of the future might combine data on the web with the private data you store on your own computer, Robert Denaro explains how the information underneath many map websites is gathered, Phil Terone is already hacking the iPod Nano, and more from Richard Giles' Gadget Show interview with John Battelle. The web seems to be changing all around us. First steps took us from static content to forums, wikis, and blogs. But when you see a site like housingmaps.com, a light goes on and you begin to understand the possibilities. Take the housing listings from Craigslist and display their locations with little pushpins on Google Maps. The listings are richer because of the geographic context, and now online maps can be immediately and dynamically customized and updated in ways that their paper counterpart cannot. What about mapping out your day? Physically. Imagine a mashup that could take your appointment book and display the route you might take from stopping for your morning coffee or dropping kids off at school, through meetings, to an evening trip to the gym. You wouldn't want to have to upload all your personal data to the web to make that happen. In the future, browsers might help you integrate the data on your hard drive with the public information on the web. Mark Hedlund has more to say about that later in the program. You'll also hear how Navtech gathers the data that you see on Google Maps and other navigation sites. All of this is part of what's being called Web 2.0. Tim O'Reilly talks a bit about what makes a site Web 2.0 and explains the underlying idea of the architecture of participation. To understand Web 2.0, it helps to think about sites that are, well, still at version 1.0, and about the sites that did and didn't survive the dot-com bust.
As we thought about it, we realized that there were some distinguishing characteristics of the companies that had survived and prospered in the Web 1.0 era, you know, the companies that had become multi-billion dollar companies, the Yahoos, the Googles, the Amazons, the Ebays, and they had something in common that many of the failed companies had just missed. And what's more, many of them were pioneering new innovations and that were driving the industry forward. And next, there was a whole class of new startups that were leveraging some of the same ideas, many cases taking them even further. There's a couple of core characteristics. And, often they're maybe easiest to grasp by contrast. James Governor of Redmonk research firm posted a really nice set of comparisons. He wrote Web 1.0, content created by someone else. Web 2.0, content created by the user. Web 1.0, the architecture of consumption, otherwise known as the read-only web. Web 2.0, the architecture of participation. That's actually a phrase I coined to really try to describe how the secret of success on the web appeared to be harnessing the users. You know, and this is sometimes in non-obvious ways. Network-enabled participation was starting to affect other areas. And so, say, take Google as an example. The initial insight that distinguished Google from rivals such as Alta Vista and gave them better search results was leveraging the link structure of the web. Users build the relevance into Google. It's not done by just sort of semantic analysis of the documents, which is what everybody else was doing up to that point. Google realized that the users, making the difference. And so, in some sense, Google is what you could call a collective intelligence application. So, the architecture of participation is how do you build a site, you know, that's architected such that the users help to build the service. So, in the case of Google, it was already implicit in the web, but then they introduced the next set of products, AdSense, again, harnessing the users. And that leads you to another principle. Down there, the long tail, which has gotten a lot of press since Chris Anderson introduced that term. The idea that there's money to be made in products that are really too insignificant to to be carried in a brick and mortar store. And again, looking at Google, you see that AdSense is a long tail product. By using automation, they're able, and customer self-service, which is another important part of it, they're able to monetize websites that would never, be able to be addressed by a Web 1.0 ad company like DoubleClick. DoubleClick has 1,000 or 2,000 customers. Google, again, I don't have an actual count, but I'd be surprised if there aren't hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of AdSense customers. So you see there this Google has figured out how to become a real Internet-centric company. So another principle in the Web 1.0, everybody was trying to build walled gardens and find ways to make their content sticky or their site sticky, keep people in. And increasingly you see sites that are prospering by creating open fields. The whole strategy of a site like Flickr for photo sharing is about building out the network of people who use the photos, getting them out syndicated off to other sites. So RSS, for example, is a really deep, and syndication is a really deep part of the Web 2.0 idea. You could also think of, again, going back to James Governor's list, he had Web 1.0 as the download culture and Web 2.0 as the remix culture. People are looking to be able to put together their own content, their own products. Remix applies to everything from creating music playlists to actually hacking on hardware. So these characteristics we're starting to understand, and the point of the conference for us is to try to tease out some of the core principles that are going to be the hallmarks and the guides to success in this new era.
Tim O'Reilly. This excerpt was taken from the recent Web 2.0 conference call. The show notes provide links to the Web 2.0 conference site at web2con.com, as well as to the entire 30-minute program, which is hosted by Information Week. We'll have another excerpt from this press conference in next week's show. This is Distributing the Future. You'll find all the links from Distributing the Future in our show notes at www.oreillynet.com/future. Send email to future@oreilly.com. Google Maps has gotten a lot of attention because it changes the way we think about the browser. If you haven't tried it, click on some part of the map and drag it. The whole page moves. This is huge. It's not the way you interacted with a browser before. Usually you clicked and you went to a link, or maybe you displayed a drop-down list. Now the whole page looks live. A lot of the secrets behind what makes this work is explained by Ajax, and we'll return to that in future shows. For now, Mark Hedlund, an entrepreneur in residence at O'Reilly Media, has been thinking about different browser issues. He asks, do you really want to upload all of your personal data to the web in order to use one of these full-featured browser apps? Mark's been thinking about some of the privacy issues with this, and he thinks you might want to head to a world in which browsers can combine the data from your hard drive with the public data on the web. Combining local and remote data can be confusing, and so Mark explains.
A lot of the applications that we're seeing these days expect you to upload all of your data to the web. So if you're using, say Gmail, all of your email is stored on a hard drive at Google's offices, and they keep track of it for you. And of course, that's great for a lot of reasons, because it means that wherever you are in the world, whatever computer you're using, you're able to get to that data and see the most updated version of your email. For privacy reasons, for security reasons, for preferences reasons, or whatever else, people might have an interest in not having all of their data on hard drives that Google owns, but instead having some or all of their data on hard drives that they own. So can you have a web application that takes some data off of a website that is shared data amongst a bunch of users, that is updated on a bunch of different computers so that it's easy for you to get to it around the world? And can you mix that data with some data that's kept on your hard drive? Let's take as an example a medical application. Let's say that you wanted to have a web interface that kept some of your data up on the web, but there were certain things you just didn't want to put on the web. You didn't want to put your status with the disease, like if you're HIV positive or you didn't want to put some of the diseases you're collecting information about or whatever, it seems to me that you could have an application where a selection of data is taken down from the web to your browser, and then a selection of data is taken off your hard drive but not sent up to the website you're interacting with. Essentially, this is sort of a join of data between web data and local data using sort of an AJAX interface to help you interact with that. I don't think that this is really what the browser makers are thinking of right now, but I think there are good arguments for it, the medical application being one. And while, of course, you have a lot of data that would be tied to the website no matter what, you could also see a need for how to make sure that the browser is able to get the data, use it locally, but not use it on the web. Because generally, if you give some data to an AJAX application, then that AJAX application is going to be able to forward it anywhere on the web that it wants to. Mitchell Baker from the Mozilla Foundation suggested that maybe one thing that could happen is you could have something in the browser that, from a UI perspective, looks like the SSL lock indicator that says whatever data you're using, it's staying on your hard drive. The moment you get into this idea of how does the user understand what the difference is between local data and remote data, then you immediately get into confusion. And you can see that actually really clearly in the first release of Google Desktop. They just put out a new release, which is different in this respect. But the way that they were doing it originally was that you would call up your web browser and you would do a search. And if you had Google Desktop installed or Google Local Search installed, then what you would see is results from the web mixed in with results from your hard drive. I've heard the same reaction again and again and again, which is, how did my email get uploaded to Google? I didn't mean for it to get uploaded to Google. Why is my Excel spreadsheet or my Word document up there on Google right now? So I think that there is something that's happening with the desktop searches that is showing that if you put all of this data together in a browser today, people will not understand what's going on.
Mark Hedlund blogs at radar.oreilly.com. We reached Mark via Skype. We're distributing the future. As Mark pointed out in his piece, there's a lot of art involved in presenting the data. Think about the last time you needed directions to get from here to there. Did you use MapQuest.com, Maps.Google.com, Maps.Yahoo.com, or Maps.A9.com? All of the sites use the same data provided by Navtech. Some people like one site better than another, but they're all depending on the same underlying geographic information. Did you ever think about what it would take to gather all that data? You could just look at satellite pictures, but if you've ever taken a close look at those on Google Maps or on Microsoft's Terra server, as cool and as data-rich as those bird's-eye views are, there's still a lot of information that you can't get from the sky. Navtech's Robert Denaro recently spoke at Wear 2.0 about why their drivers cover about 10,000 miles a day gathering data that's used by these familiar websites as well as by many large customers.
Driving the streets, isn't that an absurd business model? And the answer is yes, it is an absurd business model. It's horrendously expensive. It's very time-consuming. The quality implications are staggering. The problem is it's the only way to get the right data. Navtech is out there doing it every day. Last year alone, we were driving at around 10,000 miles per day. That works out to about 3 million miles a year. And just in North America, we found 120,000 dividers and about 50,000 gates that are going to affect getting through those streets. And these are things you can't see in the satellite images. How about this road that the local map said it went through? Well, it does if you get out of your car and walk. There's a local map in Valencia County. It shows a grid of a development going in. But from the satellite imagery, it did appear that those streets and avenues were in there. But as part of our process, we need to field verify everything. And apparently this community had been planned since the 70s, and they never implemented it, don't have any plans to implement it. Yet from the public data, it said there were things in there, there was data there. For some special applications, we even have vehicles equipped with inertial measurement units and inclinometers, so we can get much, much more precise data, even correcting the GPS data. And this is more for some of the new features coming along for automobiles where your car will be able to tell you that you're going too fast for the turn that's coming up ahead with this rather long vehicle that wouldn't be able to make it around sharp turns. And these kind of companies, in a commercial sense, will rely on our data for this kind of information to plan those routes. Maybe the data that they're going to plan on involves other attributes, such as what's the weight limit, what's the where are hazardous materials allowed or not allowed. So these are the kinds of data that are available in that database besides just geometry. And then video capture as well, as I said, usually of signage is a big reason we're doing that, because you'd like your nav system to say, take the exit that reads such and such. Well, we have to know what those signs say. If we're going to have a car tell you that you're exceeding the speed limit, then we want to have that with very high reliability. We don't want to have any errors in that. In the database, we'll code that no left turn restriction. We'll code whether that's a legal restriction, you're just not allowed because you can't turn there, maybe it's a one-way street, or whether it is physically a median. So this company that was writing a pedestrian navigation solution would ignore the legal restrictions because you can certainly walk around the corner, that's okay, but they honored the medians because they're not going to ask somebody to climb over a median in order to make a left turn. So there are elements in the database that allow you to provide different kinds of navigation. But it's important to remember Navtech's data, yes, we collect the geometry, but we collect 160 attributes above that, about every stretch of road, up to 160 attributes. So the value is really in those attributes, which makes navigation possible, not just in the geometry.
Navtech's Robert Denaro from the WEAR 2.0 conference in July in San Francisco. As always, you'll find links for all of the stories in our show notes posted at www.oreillynet.com/future. To suggest stories or provide feedback, send email to future@oreilly.com to help shape distributing the future. Make Magazine Associate Editor Phil Terone is the ultimate early adopter when it comes to gadgets and technology. Before most people have held an iPod Nano in their hand, Phil's purchased one and figured out how to hack it to suit his tastes and needs. In this week's episode of Void Your Warranty, Phil shows you how to change what's displayed on your new Nano.
So the new iPod Nano is out. It's a little tiny iPod. It's probably one of the smallest music players that I've certainly ever used. Beautiful screen, all sorts of neat stuff, but what good is it if you can't hack it? Well, it's not as hackable as the other iPods. I still like my older iPod where I can put Podzilla and record high-quality audio and change all the graphics, but you can hack the iPod Nano. There'll be more hacks down the road, but this is what you can do now. The first thing that I did with mine is I changed some of the text strings. The text strings are the little bits of text on the iPod screen, so where it says iPod at the top or do not disconnect, you can change those. I changed mine to say makeup at the top, and instead of do not disconnect, I had it say Make Magazine because it sits on my desk all day and I'd rather have it say something a little bit more interesting. Plus, it personalizes it. So if you're on a PC, you download a program called iPod Wizard. And once you download iPod Wizard, you get a program from Apple called iPod Updater. And that allows you to restore the iPod if anything happens to it. But one of the other neat things you can do is modify the file that it restores so you can change the text and sync it back over. Once you sync it back over, iPod reboots and you can see your new text on the screen. Don't worry, I'm going to give you the URL at the end of this so you can learn how to do this on your own. If you're on a Mac, you can also do that as well with a program called AlterPod. One of the other things you can do on a PC is change the fonts. I thought the fonts were a little thick, a little bold, and I wanted a slightly thinner font on my iPod. So you can actually take any font that's on your PC system and use that on the iPod screen. Now, sometimes it doesn't work out that well because the iPod was specifically designed for certain types of fonts, so some of them don't look so good. So there's a little bit of trial and error with this warranty voiding experiment. And if you want to change the graphics right now, the Nano stores graphics a little bit different than the older iPods. So the graphics come over a little weird. They look a little discolored and pixelated. And so when you put graphics back on it, if you want to change, say, the Do Not Disconnect X that blinks all day, I wanted to put a little logo and a little happy face on it instead. It doesn't look that great now, so you have to play around with the colors to make it look good, and later on there'll be updates to the software. But the name of the software is AlterPod, and you can take the firmware off, and then, just like you did on your PC, you can modify the firmware, change graphics, you can change text on your Mac to the iPod as well, and then you sync it back over. You basically take that backup and restore the iPod back to what it thinks is the original firmware, but it's modified. If you want to try this on your own, you can go to makezine.com and do a search for Nano, and our tutorial is the first link. So, happy hacking!
Phil Terone, associate editor of Make Magazine. He can discover and write about new and cool projects almost as fast as you can read. You can try to keep up with him at www.makezine.com, where you can find a write-up of these and other Nano hacks. John Patel is described as the band manager for the website Boing Boing. He explains that he helped them work out the details of making the site financially sound without selling out. The metaphor is that they're the band and he's the manager. Patel realizes that there's a business in providing this service to bloggers and other content providers who want to focus on their art and their craft and not on the business end of it all. This is our second excerpt from Richard Giles' Gadget Show interview with John Patel, repodcast with permission. You can find The Gadget Show at www.thepodcastnetwork.com/gadget.
If you were going to make a living in the field of authoring content, whether it's, you know, audio in your case or, you know, text in the case of Boing Boing for the most part, sort of the traditional media model, you needed to indenture yourself to a publisher who had the capital invested to create distribution, manufacturing, you know, marketing, all those things you need to support a massive media infrastructure, whether it's a newspaper or a magazine, which has enormous costs of distribution and marketing and manufacturing, or a television network or whatever. The internet has sort of changed those rules and I think allowed authors to become more independent and have a relationship that looks a bit more like a musician who attaches themselves to a label but really works independent of them. Many musicians don't feel like they work for the label, but rather the label is, you know, in their cases, sometimes a necessary evil. But I think that you can have a label relationship where, in fact, the label is your partner and helping you. And that comes down to who owns the intellectual property and who's taking advantage of who. So if you work as a true partner, you're not taking advantage of each other. You're working together to try to get your voice out and compensated appropriately. There are a number of remarkable blog sites written by passionate people who are clearly committed both to the thing they're creating as well as the audience that is supporting the thing they're creating by paying attention to it and being part of the conversation that occurs between an author and an audience, which is a conversation like the conversation that happens between a musician and an audience. But most good authors like being good at being authors and not necessarily being good at selling advertising on their site or figuring out the technology implications of how to make their site better or more efficient or more usable. And so that's where FM comes in, is that we bring together a number of sites into sort of a cluster of like-minded sites in an area, for example, in technology or later in media or entertainment or games or something like that. And then on the other side, we introduce those sites to marketers who want to be part of the conversation on that site, but in a way that is appropriate for the site. If you're trying to reach millions of people through blogs, it's sort of difficult because you'd have to negotiate with 10 or 20 or 30 different blogs to kind of get the coverage that you might want for your campaign. The combination of blogging and search and RSS and now podcasting was changing the fabric of media and the fabric of culture, and that it was creating opportunities that didn't exist before to be found down the tail. That, you know, sites that had 10,000 dedicated, passionate readers could find a way to thrive as economically viable because for whatever the thing is that they happen to be passionate about, it's relatively easy to be found, right, through search. So it's become sort of the connective tissue of a vibrant set of microeconomies that taken together is extremely powerful.
John Patel and Richard Giles on The Gadget Show. Thanks, Richard, for giving us permission to excerpt your program. Also, thanks to our guests, Tim O'Reilly, Robert Denaro, Phil Terone, and Mark Hedlund. You'll find more information in our show notes at www.oreillynet.com/future. We're betaing this new show in public so that we can benefit from your comments, criticisms, and suggestions. If you have ideas to share with us, send email to future@oreilly.com. I'm Daniel Steinberg. Distributing the Future is a production of O'Reilly Media. Special thanks to David Bettino for composing and performing this theme music. Visit David's website at www.batmosphere.com. David also edits the O'Reilly Digital Audio site at digitalmedia.oreilly.com. This program was produced on Mac OS X Tiger using Soundtrack Pro, Audio Hijack Pro, and Skype.